the book of Nehemiah. One book each week. And tonight we come to this great book. I think it's a great book, just as I thought, as I said last week, the book of Ezra is a great book. Very often, very neglected. Ezra, Nehemiah, next week Esther. And then I think we'll have a break in our studies, one book at a time. It brings us to the end of the history books. As a matter of fact, the book of Esther is set earlier in the history of Israel than the book of Nehemiah. So Nehemiah is really the last of the history books of the Old Testament. And then it starts again, as far as history is concerned, with John the Baptist in the New Testament. The Persian Empire was the biggest that there had ever been up to then, and when they conquered Babylon, they found that there were many groups of people in Babylon, the Babylonian Empire, who had been carried into exile from various countries. And one such group of people, you remember, were the Jews from Judah, 900 miles away across the desert. Or, if you preferred the safer route, but the longer route, around what was called the Fertile Crescent. And many people with maps in the back of the Bible some other time can find the route up the rivers, by the rivers Euphrates and Tigris, and then right down through past Mount Hermon, through Syria, past Mount Hermon, down to Judah. And you recall that Jerusalem lay in ruins. The Babylonians had absolutely destroyed it, and they'd knocked down the temple and ravaged it, and even the walls, hardly one stone upon another. It was just rubble, hardly any people lived there, and God's people were taken as a punishment, a chastisement, into exile. But when Cyrus the Persian king came to the throne and conquered, when he conquered Babylon, he allowed the Jews to go back. Many of them didn't want to go, alas, by then, as we recalled last week. But many of them did go. A tremendous group of people, something like 40,000, went back with the first return in about 537 BC. And then another group went with Ezra, the scribe and the preacher, in 458 BC. Now, we take up the story in this book of Nehemiah. The words, chapter 1, the words of Nehemiah, the son of Hakaliah. Now, if you want to know who and what Nehemiah was, you have to look at the last verse of the first chapter. I was cupbearer to the king. And if you want to know what king he's referring to, he says, in the month of Nisan, this is chapter 2, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes. Now that's who he was the cupbearer to the king of Persia, King Artaxerxes. Now you may not think that cupbearer means very much, but as a matter of fact, it was a very important position. It was rather like being a sort of prime minister. It was a position of great trust. Technically, what the cupbearer did was to take a sip out of every cup that was handed to the king to make sure it hadn't been poisoned. If the cupbearer fell dead, then the king didn't drink what was coming his way. So it was a sort of safeguard. But there was more to it than that. Because it was a position of such trust, it was a position of responsibility. And Nehemiah, and much of this book is autobiographical, held this, even though he was a Jew, and even though he was in exile, though he'd been born in exile, of course, he held this great responsibility. Now, he knew that there had been this, about 100 years before, there had been this return to Jerusalem, and he wondered how his people were getting on. And chapter 1 opens with bad news. His brother came to him and said that some people had come, verse 2, from Judah, and they said that things were very bad there. The people were in great trouble. The wall of Jerusalem was broken down, its gates destroyed by fire. They'd been stopped from the rebuilding of it. The temple had been rebuilt under Zerubbabel, But it was nothing like the glory of the temple of Solomon. But still they had a temple, but nevertheless the city had not been rebuilt, and most important, the walls had not been rebuilt. Verse 4, chapter 1, when I heard those words, I sat down and wept and mourned for days. So although he was in a position of responsibility, he probably lived in great comfort. He was an important man in Persia. His heart was with his people, just as Joseph's had been when they were down in Egypt, you remember. And so he fasted and he prayed to the God of heaven. And he reminded God of his great covenant. His prayer begins with the greatness of God, just as prayer should begin like that. It's good to do that. And then he reminds himself in his prayer that God is one who is personal. He hears and he sees and he asks God to do just that for the people of Israel. He acknowledges the sins of the people of Israel and that God has been just in punishing them. But now in justice he asks him to be merciful. And he speaks of the situation that they are in. Now he's going to go into the king, and he asks at the end of the chapter, grant him mercy in the sight of this man. That's grant me, thy servant, mercy in the sight of this man, the king. Well, it was 4 months before, in fact, anything happened. And in the month of April, Nisan, he went in before King Artaxerxes, and he risked his life for two reasons. First of all, he risked his life because he looked so miserable. And you risked your life if you were a servant of the king and you looked miserable. The king liked happy people around him. It's quite true. And potentates in that day had such power that if anybody looked miserable and depressed and so on, they could have them put to death. And he couldn't help it because his heart was in Jerusalem and he'd had this bad news. And Artaxerxes says, what's the matter with you today? You're not usually looking like that. Why are you looking like that? So that was number one risk. Number two was to actually tell the king why and to make his request. Because if you remember from Ezra and chapter 4, the reason why the walls were not being rebuilt was because this Artaxerxes had made a decree that they were not to be rebuilt. He had been convinced by certain letters and by looking in his archives that this had been a rebellious city, that it had cost a lot of lives in its conquest, and therefore it would be better for it not to be rebuilt. And therefore for Nehemiah to ask, as he was going to do, that King Artaxerxes allow him to go back to Jerusalem with letters from the great emperor, a letter of authority to build up the walls, a letter asking for free passage throughout the various parts of the empire to travel the 900 miles and for protection, and the materials to build up the walls and the fortresses. Remember, it was like building a fortress, was really to risk his life. But notice verse 8. The king granted me what I asked for. The good hand of my God was upon me. That's why. It was God's will, and God moved the heart and the mind of Artaxerxes. So he arrives. What a good man was Nehemiah to give up the luxuries and the position he had in Persia and in Babylon to come back to this ruined city, especially as he was in for some pretty hot opposition. Well, the opposition is mentioned first of all in verse 10. When Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the servant, the Ammonite, heard this, it displeased them greatly that someone had come to seek the welfare of the children of Israel. And they almost, if you like, represent the devil's servants. And believe you me, when God sets a man up to do a great work for him, or a boy, or a girl, or a woman, it doesn't matter who it is, you'll have opposition. The devil will not like it. And that's what happened. Nevertheless, Nehemiah had arrived. And he did a strange thing. He didn't tell the authorities that were there what he had come for, first of all. He was a very shrewd man. And he decided he would do an inspection himself. So he got up in the middle of the night for 3 consecutive nights. Well, after 3 days, and he got up in the night, and he went round on his mule with just one or two others, and he inspected the walls. And the rubble in places was so bad that even his donkey couldn't get through it or step over it. So he had a good idea of what was required. Says one writer, he will not begin until he has counted the cost, and then he will not stop until the work is completed. May that be a lesson to us all. But the opposition is going to be active. Look at 2:19. When Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the servant the Ammonite and Geshem, here comes the third of the mafia trio who are going to be after him, Geshem the Arab, heard of it, they derided us and despised us and said, what is this thing that you are doing? Are you rebelling against the king? No, he wasn't, because he had letters of authority, but this is what they were going to suggest. They were going to suggest it again too. What does he reply? Verse 20, the God of heaven will make us prosper. That's who we've come for. We're doing it for him. He will make us prosper. Now in chapter 3, we read of how they got started. Nehemiah was a great leader, and he got everyone doing their share of building the walls. First of all, the high priest was to set the example. No sitting in the vestry while other people did it. Everybody to the hand to the to not to the plow but to the stones, to the wall. Tremendous job. It wasn't like just like building a brick wall around your garden. This was huge blocks of stones. It was to be like a fortress wall with great towers, so wide in fact that later on they could have a tremendous procession and choirs on the top of the wall all the way around. Remember, it was that kind of wall. So the high priest with some of the other priests, they were to work on one part, chapter 3. They started at the sheep gate. And then verse 2, next to him the men of Jericho. Some who lived from Jericho were brought in to do a bit. Then verse 3, the sons of Hasanah built the fish gate, laid its beams and set its doors, its bolts and its bars. Now obviously we can't go right through this, but it's very, very interesting in places. Look at verse 5. Next to them, the Tekoites, people from Tekoa. We shall study a prophet one day who came from there. Next to them, the Tekoites repaired, but their nobles did not put their necks to the work of the Lord, of their Lord. Either that means they didn't get down to the work of God, or else they wouldn't obey their superiors, their overseers. Whatever is the original meaning, these nobles from Tekoa thought it was beneath them to work on building walls. And that's very sad. Nehemiah made a note of that, because everyone was to take their part. I hope there's nobody here tonight who thinks that any job is beneath your dignity. Remember, the Son of God was a carpenter. Never forget that. Well, we go on to verse 8. Next to them, Uzziel, the son of Harhiah, goldsmiths. So they didn't say, oh no, we're goldsmiths. We only do goldsmith work. We belong to the National Union of Goldsmiths. And this is a demarcation issue. We're not stonemasons. We won't do anything but goldsmiths. Nehemiah said, get busy on the walls. Everybody, who comes next? Well, in the King James, it's apothecaries. Perfumers. People who made perfume. Well, they weren't going to make nice smelly bricks. It was nothing to do with that. Everybody had to work. But we are perfumers. On with the job. And they got on with the broad wall. And so it goes on. Verse 9, next to them, Rephaiah, the son of Hur, ruler of half the district of Jerusalem. The mayor of half of Jerusalem. He got down to it. And so on. Verse 12. Next to him, Shallum, the son of Haloshesh. Haloshesh. Ruler of the other half. He was the other mayor. And his daughters. Ah, come on, girls. You're on there. Everybody. Everybody onto this. Everybody. Verse 16. After him, Nehemiah. This was probably a different Nehemiah. The son of Azbuk, ruler of half the district of Bezer, repaired to a point opposite the sepulchres of David, to the artificial pool, and to the house of the mighty men. Very interesting, you know, to write your own paraphrase of the Bible sometimes. I'm always interested to see what paraphrasers have done and Living Bible, Kenneth Taylor, who I will be reading to you from in a minute, he says that that was the old officers' club. That's right. End of verse 16, the house of the mighty men, the old officers' club. They built that up again, or up to where it used to be. Well, in this chapter we have all that. It's most interesting. And you will find, if you study it carefully, that in some cases Nehemiah was very clever. He put people to build the part of the wall which was near to where they lived. So they had a vested interest in doing it well, so that there wasn't a weak point near their house. You see, he was a shrewd man. But, chapter 4, opposition. Along comes Sanballat again. Oh dear. Do you know, when I was a boy, in our mission, one of our chiefs in our mission was called Sam Barrett. And whenever I used to read the book of Nehemiah, I used to feel sorry for him, because some people used to read it like Sam Barrett, and everyone used to look at Sam Barrett. Now, chapter 4, when Sanballat heard that we were building the wall, he was angry and greatly enraged. Now, here were his weapons. First of all, ridicule. He ridiculed the Jews, just as the devil will move people to ridicule you if you're working for the Lord. Boys and girls tonight, at school, the devil will see there's a few Sanballats and Tobias and Geshems around who will ridicule you because you're serving the Lord. And he said, verse 2, in the presence of his brethren and of the army of Samaria, you see, he didn't mobilize the army to a frontal attack because Nehemiah had come with authority from Artaxerxes, but they were going to harass them. What are these Jews, feeble Jews, doing? Will they restore things? Will they sacrifice? Will they finish up in a day? Goodness me, look at the way they're working. They think they're going to do it in a day. Big joke. That's what they say. Will they revive the stones out of the heaps of rubbish? Look at all the rubbish. How on earth can they do anything with that lot? And the burned ones at that, it was limestone, and if it's burned limestone, it's very feeble. It cracks. And so they mocked them. Tobiah the Ammonite was by him. People usually gang up together when they ridicule Christians. They're not so good at it on their own, but if they can get a little bit of a group together. And he said, yes, what they are building, if a fox goes upon it, he will break down their stone wall. And you could imagine them all, oh, how funny. Well, listen to Nehemiah, verse 4. Hear, O our God, for we are despised. Turn back their taunts upon their own heads. Give them up to be plundered in a land where they are captives. Do not cover their guilt, and let not their sin be blotted out from thy sight, for they have provoked thee to anger before the builders. Now that doesn't sound very much like loving your enemies. But you see, they saw it as an insult to God and the honor of God's name and God's city, Zion's city. Their opposition was not really against Nehemiah. It was against God. And that's why they prayed like that. So verse 6, we built the wall, and all the wall was joined together to half its height. Why? Very important. Underline it in your Bible. For the people had a mind to work. Would to God that could be said of every church of Jesus Christ. For the people had a mind to work. Not half-hearted, thinking they were doing God a favour. They'd see if they could spare a few minutes. Not a bit. All right, Sanballat and Tobiah and the Arabs and the Ammonites, they were surrounded by enemies all around Jerusalem. They plotted together, verse 8, to come and fight against Jerusalem. Terrorism and cause confusion in it. What was Nehemiah's answer to that? We prayed to our God and set a guard as a protection against them day and night. Both, you see. Both. Cromwell used to tell his troops, trust in God and keep your powder dry. You see, you're right. Some people think it's either all of man and forget about God, or else trust God and do nothing. But Nehemiah said, trust God and keep your powder dry. He prayed to God and set a guard to protect them. Verse 10, Judah said, the strength of the burden bearers is failing. Have we got any burden bearers in Lansdowne? Every church needs its burden bearers. But sometimes our strength fails. And there is much rubbish, not in Lansdowne, I hope, but sometimes there is. Some pastors I know, when they first go to a work, one of the first things they have to do before they can build the walls is to get rid of the rubbish. And it's very difficult and costly and hard. The preaching of the word sorts people out. And they feel the burden of the day. Well, he said to God, verse 14, halfway down, do not be afraid of them. Remember the Lord, who is great and terrible, and fight for your brethren, your sons, your daughters, your wives, your homes. Right. So what did they do? Well, he put guards on, and he did something else as well. As they worked, they kept their sword girded beside them. Verse 18, each of the builders had his sword girded at his side while he built. So C.H. Spurgeon, when he invented a name for the magazine 100 years ago of his church in London, his great church, he called it what? The sword and the trowel. That's it. The sword and the trowel. The enemy will try to stop the work. We're to resist him. We're to fight him. And we're to build. The sword and the trowel. It comes from Nehemiah. That's how they were to do it. And of course they were very scattered all round the walls. The whole circle of the city was busy. So therefore they had a trumpeter ready to blow the trumpet if the attack came in one particular place, to mobilize all the people to that attack. Just as sometimes when someone is under special attack, we mobilize one another and blow the trumpet and we pray and ask God to deliver them, as we did in the case of our brother. Our God will fight for us, verse 20. So they labored at the work, 21. Half of them held the spears from the break of dawn till the stars came out. Didn't work short hours. I also said to the people at that time, let every man and his servant pass the night within Jerusalem. See, many of them came from villages round about. There weren't all that many who were resident in Jerusalem. But Nehemiah didn't let them go home because they might have been got at or assassinated. They might never come back. Indeed, look at verse 23. So neither I, nor my brethren, nor my servants, nor the men of the guard who followed me, none of us, took off our clothes. Each kept his weapon in his hand. Now that's a bit difficult at the end to translate. And literally it is, each his weapon, the water. So generally what nice people do when they translate it is, they say it means they never took off their clothes except to have a bath, of course. Because it did take 52 days, and after 52 days of rather hectic work, they would need a wash and a bath. So that's what they think it probably means. I'm sure it does, of course. But they worked very, very hard. And Nehemiah set the example. You see, neither I nor my brethren. That was the way they did the Lord's work. Now chapter 5 turns its attention to a very different thing. Do you know, as if they didn't have enough trouble from the Babylonians and then coming back from exile and now these opponents from Samaria and Ashdod and the Arabians and all around them, as if they didn't have enough problems, they even had injustice from their fellow Jews. And so Nehemiah had to sort out something there. You see, they had been so heavily taxed, they couldn't pay their taxes. They'd had to mortgage their possessions to rich Jews, just as some of you have got your houses on mortgage, and then in order to pay off some debt, you've taken out a second mortgage, until eventually you're paying all the money you pay is the interest. You never see the capital go down. And that's what they were finding. And they hadn't got anything. And they were in terrible trouble, and the rates of interest were exorbitant, and they were even having to sell some of their own loved ones into slavery to foreigners. And that was against the law of Exodus 22:25. And when he found out about that, Nehemiah was really angry, verse 6, chapter 5, verse 6. And he called them all together, and he gave them a terrific ticking off. And And when it's told us about that, I just want to read you from the Living Bible. I just want to read you from verse 14 onwards. Remember, this is autobiographical. Nehemiah says this: I would like to mention that for the entire 12 years that I was governor of Judah, from the 20th until the 32nd year of the reign of King Artaxerxes, my aides and I accepted no salaries or other assistance from the people of Israel. This was quite a contrast to the former governors, who had demanded food and wine and $100 a day in cash, and had put the population at the mercy of their aides who tyrannized them. But I obeyed God and did not act that way. I stayed at work on the wall and refused to speculate in land. I also required my officials to spend time on the wall. All this despite the fact that I regularly fed 150 Jewish officials at my table, besides visitors from other countries. He goes on to speak of what that cost. Yet I refused to make a special levy against the people, for they were already having a difficult time. Oh my God, please keep in mind all that I've done for these people and bless me for it. I thought it was rather lovely. The Bible is a very honest book, you know. A very honest book. You might have thought, how very unspiritual to pray like that and just to mention and just to say how his good works. Well, perhaps it was, I don't know. But you see, he left a lot behind and he'd given up a great deal. And last Sunday evening we saw that Jesus said, nobody who has left everything for my name's sake will be the loser by it. And Nehemiah just said, please bless me for it. And God did. Now chapter 6, opposition renewed. When it was reported to Sanballat, here he is again, and Tobiah and to Geshem the Arab, that I had built the wall and there was no breach left in it, but the gates hadn't been set up yet, well, they started again. First of all, they attempted to assassinate Nehemiah. They asked him if he would go out and meet them and parley with them several miles from Jerusalem at a place called Ono. And you can easily remember what his reply was. He said, oh no. Look at verse 3. And I sent messengers to them saying, and this is one of my favorite verses in the Bible. God used this to strengthen my hand once. And the Lord led me to this text. I am doing a great work, and I cannot come down. Why should the work stop while I leave it and come down to you? They said, all we want is to talk. We just want to negotiate. We just want to talk things over. Nehemiah said, I'm doing a great work and I haven't got time to stop. And they tried four times and he wouldn't come. So they tried another one, verse 5 onwards. They sent an open letter. Now we do that. People write open letters to people. Politicians or something. They write an open letter to a politician and send copies to all the newspapers so that everybody reads it. It's an open letter. And then you have it on the television screen and so on. They want everyone to know what they're saying. And that's what they did. They sent an open letter. And in this open letter it said that Geshem, who had been quite an important person, had noticed that they were rebuilding the wall and had heard it reported that Nehemiah had in mind to become the king and to rebel against the Persians once the wall was complete and they had a fortress city. And they would have to make sure that Artaxerxes got to hear about this, of course. It was rumoured. But he answered them that it was not true and that God would strengthen his hand. So they tried a third thing. That was to trap him. They got a false prophet, Shemaiah, to say, I have been told from the Lord, a message for you from the Lord, thus saith the Lord, they're going to kill you, take shelter in the temple, in the holy place. Now, Nehemiah was not a priest, and he wasn't allowed into the holy place. And he knew that. And he realized it was a ruse, and that this prophet had been hired, and so he wouldn't go. And he prayed again. So verse 15 of chapter 6, the wall was finished. on the 25th day of the month Elul, in 52 days, in less than 2 months, they'd done the job. And when the enemies even heard of it, they had to acknowledge that God had been in it and had helped them. Well, now we go on to chapter 7, and we can speed up now. Chapter 7, the population and the houses had to be increased. Now they've got the wall all around, they wanted to build up the city. And chapter 7 is a list of people. As a matter of fact, it's probably a list of the very first people who came in 5 through 8, because it's the same as Ezra 2. Now in chapter 8, we have a very interesting chapter. It's Enter Ezra, whose book we learnt about last week. Ezra the great man. Do you remember that key text of Ezra 7:10? Ezra had set his heart to study the law, to do it, and to teach it. He studied the law, he obeyed the law, and he shared the law, the word of God, the Bible. Great man, Ezra. Well, that's exactly what he was going to do with Israel. They all came round in front of the water gate into a great piazza or square. And he stood upon a pulpit, a wooden pulpit, verse 4, and he read to them from early morning until midday. And they stood to listen. And he had 13 deacons who helped him. And I want you to notice verse 8. They read from the book. This is 8:8. They read from the book, from the law of God, clearly, and they gave the sense so that the people understood the reading. Now we have two important principles there that have gone on right down to the present day. First of all, the people are to hear the word of God in their own language. There may have been some who didn't understand Hebrew, so they translated it into Aramaic. And that has been an important principle of Bible-believing Christians down the centuries. No, it won't do for the church to say we have it in Latin. Said Wycliffe and Tyndale, the Bible shall be translated into the language of the people. Said the Reformers, the people shall have it in their own language. Thank God that that's going on today. And let it be true in England to this day and generation, you who would die for the King James Version. If there are any people here who would die for the KJV. I'm sorry, but Jacobean English is not the language of the 20th century. And it is not the language of the rising generation in this town, in this day, on this evening of grace. And we want a Bible that is in the language of the people. That's why we're looking forward to the NIV coming out in its fullness. But in addition to that, he expounded the scriptures. And here we have the forerunner of what I am doing tonight and do every Sunday. And every true preacher should do. Expound the word. Preachers are not called to give their own opinions or preach politics, but to expound the word. And I may say, Ezra did it systematically and consecutively. And I can't help but feeling that there is a good precedent set there. Take a portion of the word and expound it, explain it, apply it, bit by bit by bit by bit, just as we do on the Lord's Day. That's a good thing to do. So that's a very important verse. Now, when the people heard the word, they were convicted by it, and they wept. But they wanted them to rejoice in the word. So they said, it is a holy day, but it's a holy day. It's a day of rejoicing. So they said, look, let's celebrate the Feast of Tabernacles, of Booths, in the way that we've discovered we should from the word, and build our little tents of branches and leaves. And by the way, they went on doing that right through to our Lord's time. Feast of Tabernacles. And they had a solemn assembly, but they had a solemn assembly with joy. And that's a principle too. Now, chapter 9 is a great prayer of Ezra's, from verse 6 onwards. A wonderful prayer. In fact, both Ezra and Nehemiah are wonderful books about prayer. And I suggest that you read those prayers, if you will, for yourselves, and study the way these great men prayed. And remember, God saw fit to have these prayers recorded in his word, perhaps that we might learn how to pray. But we can't stop with it. And one of the interesting things is that Nehemiah identified himself with the sins of his people, as a good leader does when he comes before God. Chapter 10, we read of a covenant that they renewed with God. And as you work your way through that chapter, you will read how that they promised God to do all sorts of things. Verse 29, that they would walk in his law and observe all his commandments. Verse 30, they wouldn't give their daughters to be mixed marriages, to marry idol worshippers. We will not buy from them on the Sabbath. Verse 31, they'd keep the Sabbath holy. They would give their tithes. Verse 32, onwards, and bring their offerings. All this they promised in chapter 10. Chapter 11 is lists of names. Chapter 12 is the dedication of the walls. Verse 31, I brought up the princes of Judah upon the wall and appointed two great companies which gave thanks. They had a great praise and prayer meeting on the wall. Then they went in procession. One went one way, anti-clockwise, and the other went the other way, clockwise, round the top of the wall, singing with the choirs, playing with the band, until they arrived at the temple. And then they had a super hallelujah praise meeting when they got to the temple. You'll find all that in chapter 12. Now, chapter 13 is rather a strange chapter because it does speak of Nehemiah going back, as he promised, to Artaxerxes. And then when he returns again to see how things are going in Jerusalem, blow me down if they haven't gone back on their covenant. And he really is upset about it. He finds, for instance, verse 10 onwards, they haven't been giving the Levites their portions. They hadn't been properly maintaining their pastors, so the Levites had packed up and gone to work, back to his field. So he remonstrated with the officials and said, why is the house of God forsaken? And they had to put that right. And then in the bit before that, he even found his old enemy Tobiah living in a specially prepared house in the temple. If you read it there, you read he flung him out and all his furniture as well. And then if you go on toward the end of the chapter, you find that they were breaking the Sabbath day, and he had to sort that out. And then the old problem of mixed marriages. They'd gone back on their covenant and they'd married foreign women. Look at verse 26 of the last chapter. Did not Solomon, king of Israel, sin on account of such women, even though he'd been such a great king? You see, it wasn't so much that they were not allowed to marry foreign women. After all, Boaz married Ruth. But Ruth loved the Lord. Your God shall be my God, she said. Do you remember? Your people shall be my people. It was that these women continued to be idol worshippers. So it was being unequally yoked together with unbelievers. And God's people should never be that voluntarily. Different if you convert it after you're married. It's a bit vivid, is the last chapter, so I'll read it in a modern paraphrase. I'm reading from verse 23 in Kenneth Taylor's Living Bible. About the same time I realized some of the Jews had married women from Ashdod, Amnon and Moab, and that many of their children spoke in the language of Ashdod and couldn't speak the language of Judah at all. Now verse 25. So I argued with these parents, and they vowed before God that they would not let their children intermarry with non-Jews. He was quite a character, this Nehemiah, wasn't he? Well, I want to end with this. You know, this was a great work. What a great leader he was. To be able to marshal all these people who'd languished these 100 years and had rather packed it up, and to get them busy, and within 2 months, in spite of all this opposition, to build up the walls of Zion and then the houses, and he brought people in to live in there and then to cleanse them. And when they went back, instead of sort of being so discouraged, he put it all right again, even though it did mean a bit of action. He believed in a great God, and he had a great work, and he had a people who had a mind to do it with him. And I believe that's still true today. There's nothing more wonderful than to serve the Lord. Nothing more wonderful than to serve the Lord. But we must put our minds to it and do it gladly, in spite of opposition that the devil may send against us. Not be discouraged. Every man, trowel in one hand and sword in the other, and God shall have all the glory. Now, next week we'll look at the book of Esther.